Good morning, comrade. You're listening to WHIV LP New Orleans 102.3. This is an interview that Scott and I did with Mark Calendari about the coronavirus epidemic that has been hitting us. So without further ado, here is that interview.
I've responded to numerous outbreaks and disasters before in the past. And while I am in the past happy and have worked a lot, the initial question was, have I been working a lot here? And the answer is yes. The amount of hours that we've been putting in have been pretty spectacular. And again, these are the sort of hours that I'm used to spending and working abroad, but not here. You know, it's a 18-hour plane ride. It's a 2.5-hour Jeep ride. And it's a 3-hour canoe ride downriver to go someplace to put a lot of work in.
Right.
But the fact that just, you know, last week I skateboarded to the Mahalia Jackson, where I was able to get dressed up in full PPE, and I acted as the medical director for the new, you know, drive-through testing site, temporary testing site, just was very frustrating in that this was a completely preventable disease process, and we should have seen this coming. We did see this coming. You know, and the point that I was making a moment ago was essentially that this has really kind of ripped the band-aid off of anybody who at least at any point thought that this country puts capital in front of people. This is the ultimate example of how we do have a system in which capital is prioritized over people. I'm sorry that the extra noises are coming through. I apologize for
that's
that.
Okay. So I guess that's a really great way to kind of like set the stage for what's going on here. And what were some of the decisions that were made that led to this sort of crisis that could have been some of these sort of potentially preventable lessons that we did not have to learn because other places have learned them in the run up to this process before coronavirus was before cases started being tested for and discovered here. It started in China, and then it kind of like made its way through, or at least it was first discovered there, made its way through Italy, and Italy is a complete disaster right now. Spain too. Two extremely politically isolated countries, funny that, as well, at least so far as the EU goes. But anyway, what are some of the things that lessons that they learned that we could have learned but chose not to do on the front end?
So I think that the lessons learned were out of China and Singapore and most importantly, South Korea. And South Korea right now is without question the epitome of how to do things right. So when you look at the countries in Asia that did it right, you're looking at countries in Asia that also had experienced SARS, had experienced possibly the H5N1, so-called avian influenza, or the H1N1, And so these were folks that were prepared, of course, these are all systems of healthcare that have a Medicare for all, or some sort of, of course, there it would be, some sort of government-sponsored healthcare. Mm-hmm. And of course, they do have that in Italy and Spain. And I'm not saying Medicare for all is the answer. That is obviously not the case. But here in this country, the fact that we have this incredibly fragmented healthcare system is going to play a role in this. There's no question about it. But let's just kind of step that aside for right now.
In addition to that.
So let's focus right now on lessons that could have been learned. For one thing, we have never had in our lifetime something like this, like this being an epidemic or a pandemic. We've had it. We are aware of it. In 1918, the so-called great influenza outbreak.
Spanish flu.
Yeah, that's a derivative term. You shouldn't use that.
Yeah, I was just about to say we should not use the word Spanish flu.
It's inaccurate because it was originally.
Not only is it inaccurate, but it's not unlike the president referring to
the Wuhan virus when he kind of tries to gin up xenophobia through it.
Right. So, you know, my wife and I came up, Liana, who's the other co-founder of WHIV, and I came up with this term we referred to as pathogeoxenophobia. Pathogeoxenophobia is how we refer to how it is that people who experience some sort of, project xenophobia onto a pathogen that comes out of, a certain place.
To blame somebody.
Right, to blame and to deflect and to, stoke racism. Mm-hmm. So please, if you're listening, do not use the term Spanish flu. The reason why it was dubbed the Spanish flu is that it was dubbed the Italian flu, and it was dubbed the French flu, and it was dubbed the Portuguese flu, and it was dubbed, and everybody kept passing it on. And Spain in 1918 was very transparent with their cases.
Yeah.
At the time, they didn't mind it being called the Spanish flu. They were just trying to deal with the flu.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? People were dying. They didn't know what a flu was at the time. It was called la grippe, of course, which now means a cold or flu-like illness. They didn't even know what a virus was at the time. So the point, again, stepping back before getting kind of sidelined a little bit, was essentially we as a country had not experienced an epidemic of this sort. Mm-hmm. When I first started medicine, I was still seeing people that were born in like 1990. And so I would ask them about their experiences with the influenza epidemic. And I used to listen to great stories. And I wish I had the wherewithal and the foresight to have recorded some of these amazing stories of people who survived the flu of 1918. Right. Of course, these people are all passed. And it's minority of people because they'd be 102 right now or something like that. But the point is that as a society, we were woefully unprepared. But it's not that we were woefully unprepared. You had people like me, who's a public health practitioner and an infectious disease doctor, who saw this coming. Mm-hmm. And if I had any ability to stand on a mountaintop and not only shout, hey, there's something happening, and have been influential, I would have. And there was a lot of folks, it's not just me, there were a lot of folks saying, hey, this something is happening and we need to pay attention. Mm-hmm. Like, we knew that coronaviruses are the viruses that could take off. It happened a little bit with SARS. It's happening with MERS, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, which is contained in the Arabian Peninsula, largely because the intermediate host is a camel. But an easily transmissible or highly infectious virus like this novel coronavirus, or I refer to it as C19, COVID-19, whatever, that also has a respectable mortality rate is something that we've all been fearing. So this is something that could have been prevented. And it just plainly wasn't. And that's largely because we have a president and an administration that basically doesn't believe in science.
Right.
And it is ruled by religious ideology more than it is ruled by scientific ideology.
And market ideology.
What's that?
And market, like there's a religious component and there's the sort of like capitalist component. Make sure that the line keeps going up, on the stock market. Make sure that the shares are all high. Make sure the Dow is nice and high and fat and beefy. And whatever human lives that costs, it doesn't really matter. I mean, so we're, I try not to make these too, timely, but this is one of those sorts of things where we're sitting here and it's the end of March. And essentially, I've been out of school for 2 weeks. And the president of the United States, Donald Trump, it has been essentially, like for the last like 3 or 4 days, sort of railing to, kind of like repeating this line of we need to get back to work. We need to make sure that the way we treat this disease socially doesn't like ruin us, and it's not worse than, you know, the disease itself. And by that he means essentially make sure that people are going to work, make sure that they're paying their rent, make sure that things go on as usual. And if people just happen to die, well, so what?
It's priority of capital over people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all it is. There is no concern for human life in the American system. I mean, we have more cases now as it stands as recording today, Saturday, the 28th of March.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, we've long surpassed China, right? Yeah. Which, yeah, to be honest with you, if 4 or 5 weeks ago you would say, well, we surpassed China, I'd been like, nah, it'll probably be bad, but I'm not sure we're going to surpass China. We have long surpassed China.
How many people have died in the U.S.? Do you have any idea? It's several thousand.
In the U.S.?
Yeah.
2,000.
And that's more than China had.
That's like as of today.
Mm-hmm.
No, I can look up real quickly. I can look up what the mortality is in China real quickly, because I think that's a fair point.
No, I'm not trying to, I'm not trying to say that you're wrong, but I'm just trying to put a number to that.
I'm not saying that you are. No. I hear you, but it's a good number for me to know anyway. I mean, right now we have, looking at the Worldometer site, this is the site that I use.
Worldometer?
Worldometer. It's 2,211 is where we're at. And in China, their total deaths were 3,300.
Mm-hmm.
So China had 81,439 cases.
Mm-hmm.
Italy has 92,472. And in the U.S., we have 123,351,
mm-hmm,
with 2,211 deaths. Mm-hmm. So we are bumping up very quickly.
So we're number one with a bullet and rising.
Right. And even Italy long surpassed China in terms of not only of mortality mm-hmm, as well. So it has been, we are going to see moving forward, this country's going to have a lot of pain. And mm-hmm, and I have been predicting this for some time. I did not, the one thing that I had been predicting several weeks ago was that our lives were going to change and be ready for some discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we are here.
We're definitely experiencing that discomfort.
Right. And then I think that the most important thing is that people need to continue to stay indoors.
Mm-hmm.
That is without question the most important thing that people can do moving forward. But the fact that, the administration, again, is looking to try to put people, in churches by Easter is really quite shocking. And all that's going to do is that's going to create a second potential wave of new cases.
People
are starting to start interacting. Now, there are ways of getting people back to work. And you can see behind me on these boards is some of the planning that I've been doing. And I've been at work today kind of planning out how we can try to create some new clinics within the clinic system that I work in,
mm-hmm,
which is Access Health Louisiana. And what I'm trying to do is trying to recreate these clinics so that we can help take the burden and the pressure away from hospitals as people are going to start getting to the hospitals and knocking on their doors. There are ways that we can figure out by using antibody testing to see who's been infected and who hasn't, and assuming that reinfection is not possible or unlikely to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If you do have antibodies, then that means at one point you were infected, even though you may not have had symptoms, or maybe you did have symptoms and you're now recovered.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are folks that we could start to potentially think about, who want to go to work, or, we can start rethinking this thing,
mm-hmm,
but we need some definitive evidence of it before we move down that pathway.
For sure.
The bottom line is that right now people need to stay at home. We need to flatten that curve. And you have these red states that the governors still have not at all, their business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And there is going to be a tsunami of cases that are going to happen there as well. And again, largely because these are people who, one, have never had to deal with an epidemic or outbreak before, and two, mostly take their lead from from the administration, who again does not believe in science and has this strong ideology that's based on Christian fundamentalism and that is not rooted at all in science.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to Good Morning Comrade, 102.3 WHIV LP New Orleans. We have Mark Allen Derry on the line, and we also have Scott from our New Orleans East Studios, the Parish Room.
But you're right, Mark. It does seem like there's a problem people like don't understand. Like if a hurricane comes into New Orleans, people know to get a bunch of water and sit at home or like just leave. But like for this, people don't know what to do. Like they don't know the response.
Right. I mean, you know, it's not that it's, you know, public health is pretty easy, right? Like it's not like there's not much. Like, I'll be honest with you, it's not like building a rocket and, you know, sending it out to space and, like, having to think through, you know, all the complexities that go into it. You know, the birth of public health happened when a anesthesiologist was investigating why there was so much cholera in London, right, downtown London, in the Soho area. Mm-hmm. And he started to plot out the cases of people who had cholera. And the people who didn't have cholera, that had never been done before, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they still thought there was no Robert Koch and Pasteur were 10 to 20 years away from having to come up with the idea of the so-called germ theory, right? That bacteria cause diseases, right? Of course, viruses were still another 50 to 70 years away. But cholera is caused by a bacteria, right? So what he did was he basically plotted out who had cholera, what homes had cholera, what homes didn't have cholera. And he looked and he's like, oh, look at the homes that have cholera, get their drinking water from that pump. And the people who don't have cholera, get their drinking water from that pump. So let me go to the equivalent of like, you know, City Hall of London at the time. And let me ask if we can dismantle that pump. And they said no. Because they were like, that's crazy.
Right.
What you're talking about makes no sense whatsoever. He just went up and he just removed the handle from the pump and cholera cases stopped overnight. So
he just public health,
it's not that hard, right? That's a very simplified way. So what could we have done? We saw this happening. The ProPublica article at the beginning of this week was an amazing article, right? Because here's what we learned from it. Not only did we see that our senators dumped their stocks, again, the idea being that there's a priority of capital over people, and that their meeting was January 25th or January 24th, and then you had Senator Burr. Did you hear that clip of him talking to the investors at a luncheon? And he was basically saying, according to the meeting, so all the senators had been
there was a closed door meeting in Congress.
What's that?
There was a closed door session of a committee.
They were briefed on this, and Burr in his comments said this was as infectious and had as high a mortality rate as the influenza of 1918. Right. That was in late January.
Which means it's especially damning because it shows that he understands what's going on. And then he's choosing to act in the most self-interested and myopic way possible. But as far as generating public health policy, and we can get into the specifics of what the U.S. response was in a moment. But as far as like he's a senator, he's responsible for public health, or at least his job is that he's supposed to be. I mean, how he behaves, it depends on how accountable that people in his district or his state hold him. But essentially, he's in a position where he can make policy decisions or at least have policy influence on the coronavirus response or the COVID-19, C-19 response. And he chose instead to make a smart individual financial decision so that he doesn't take huge losses, because a huge epidemic or a pandemic hitting the U.S. means that the economy is going to go straight down the tube. The line will go down.
He did it. Loeffler, is that the representative from Georgia? Her husband is the chair of the New York Fed.
Dianne Feinstein,
like, who just got reelected. They all need to go. But here's a bigger point, Okay, here's a much bigger point, and that is this. You know who else was in that room? Senators Cassidy and Kennedy.
Now you're making me edit it.
Yeah, this is on the radio.
Oh, sorry.
Remember,
Go ahead. Sorry.
All right. So you know who else was in that room? When they were briefed were Senators Kennedy and Senators Cassidy. Mm-hmm. And you know what we were getting ready to do as a state and certainly as a city mm-hmm. was celebrate Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. And you know what acted as a viral accelerator and what we're seeing now, and the reason why we have the highest incidence of C19 in the world, in other words, we have the most new cases that are being diagnosed daily than anyone else in the world, mm-hmm. was because of Mardi Gras and was because largely because there was no signals from the governor or from the mayor that they received, as far as I know. And of course, that was in the paper this morning in the Advocate, which was that the mayor and the governor claimed that they had gotten no signals that there was any problem. And anything that you saw, at least on TV, the federal response was, we've got this, we're good, we're good, we're good.
So
no,
they didn't
know. They actually knew. They knew that this was a highly infectious disease. And they sat on their laurels. And Cassidy and Kennedy did not signal to the governor, did not signal to the mayor, that there was something that was potentially brewing, and now we have a massive, massive problem happening here in New Orleans.
That's blood on their hands in a very specific and direct way. Not that even like we could have, not even necessarily to say, I mean, maybe the answer would have been to cancel Mardi Gras, but not to say what it was. But at least if you're going to make that decision, you can be informed as a leader of the city or the state. You can be informed enough to make the proper decision or make the precautions, because I've also seen sort of like as a narrative about the COVID-19 business, this sort of like blaming of New Orleans for going through with Mardi Gras when, you know, they have this public health crisis that was going on.
All right. So let me put an end to that too.
Yeah.
Because you know who else celebrates Carnival? Rio.
Yeah.
Italy. Mm-hmm. Sydney has a very large queer carnival and a handful of other countries. But those four countries right there, those four cities right there, they all had very similar peaks or mm-hmm. or when they started to have their increase in their logistic rise of cases all sure. happened very similarly after Ash Wednesday,
because it's a large public gathering. I mean, it's going to happen if there is going to be it's basically a giant mixing of people, right? It's almost yeah. like and they pass things along, and guess what, you know this is one of those sorts of things that I've also seen on the back end from people like Neera Tanden from the
Center for American Progress
saying like trying to discredit people and blame people and try to like gather information on who attended Mardi Gras, which is impossible. You would need like the biggest surveillance state in the world to do that. Like, I couldn't imagine, because it's like a thing that you're in a place you don't.
1.5 million people came from out of country, out of town and out of country.
Yeah. And you don't buy a ticket. You don't buy a ticket. There's no registration for anything. What do you? How much information do you have to gather on people to figure that out? I guess is sort of my point. We're getting a little bit sidetracked, but so some of the policy decisions. So there was information that senators and policymakers at the national level did know that this COVID-19 pandemic was going to be an issue, and it would hit the U.S. and it would have a huge impact on the economy, and they decided not to act in the interest of public health, but they decided to act in the interest of their own pocketbook. And then, so what were some of the decisions that they made that were?
Well, I mean, first of all, what could have been done then? All right, so let's game this out. So it's
February, right?
Right. So we're talking late January, right?
January.
Okay. So obviously somebody put this together. I think the day that they dumped their stocks, I think the stock's the 25th. Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's say, so the first cases were really noted kind of in the reason why it's called COVID-19. COVID stands for Corona, C-O, Corona, the
viral
virus, mm-hmm. V-I, right? And then the D is disease. Mm-hmm. Corona virus disease. Then 19 means that the first cases were first identified in 2019. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's what COVID-19. So I would imagine that this was probably catching the eye of public health practitioners on a national level, probably certainly when they first started, but they probably started getting worried, I would imagine, and speculate probably around middle of the month, right? Mm-hmm. Give them a couple of days to put together a package and a presentation. Now you're looking at somewhere the third week of January. It's enough for them that they had a closed door session with senators, right, on the 25th or whatever day that was.
Correct.
Right? What could have happened at that point? Well, first of all, a decision was made for testing. Okay. Now we know about that decision, and I'm begging investigative journalists to please look into this, because the Germans came up with it's excellent. It has some problems. It allows for some false negatives to go through. That's referred to as sensitivity. And so in other words, when you measure a test, you got to either measure how good it is at measuring true positives and how good it is at measuring true negatives.
Accuracy.
Sometimes what happens is that we call that sensitivity and specificity. Uh-huh. And so when it comes to measuring the true negatives, which is referred to as sensitivity, this test has 70% sensitivity, which means that there's 30% of people will be given a negative test, but they're truly positive. We refer to that as a false negative. Nonetheless, and a positive is a positive. If you know you got a positive, great, you got a positive. In this case, that's what you care about, because it's those positives that you start doing contact tracing. Really? Okay, so now you're positive for C19. Where were you in the last 2 weeks? Oh, you were at a bachelor party in Las Vegas. Great. Well, who else was there? Okay, great. You know, then you start finding those people turn positive. You know, and that's how you do really good public health, shoe leather, contact tracing. But here's what happened. Instead of taking, so the test was made in Germany, and then it went to Switzerland to the WHO. And the WHO disseminated it around the world. When they got to the U.S., the U.S. said, no, we're going to do our own test. Now, I would love to know who made that decision, and I would love to know who got that contract to make that test, and I would love to know if there was any could there be any a benefit for somebody saying no, we'll do our own test, and then somebody may have gained financially from that. I don't know. I'm just asking.
I think it's safe to assume that was the case. I'm cynical enough to always sort of like base that as my assumption for what's happening. You know what I mean?
What's that big company, Galilee or something? I think they backed away from some kind of
Gilead.
Yeah, there you go.
Gilead is in the drug making business. They're not in the test. Okay. They're making the drug. They made the drug called Remdesivir, which basically was a drug that got tested through phase 1 and phase 2 studies, which means it's safe for humans. They tested it for Ebola. It did not do well with Ebola tests. They shelved it, and then now they're pulling it back out again. It acts as what's called a nucleotide analog. In other words, when the virus goes to replicate itself, Remdesivir gets into the prolongation of the genetic code, and it fills the spaces. So where there should be like an A or a G or a T or a U, and the reason why there's a U there is because for people who know their genetics, is that this is an RNA virus, not DNA. So, the testing then went to, so somebody did the test, they sent it to the CDC, and right off the bat, The test was terrible. It did not perform well at all. After the CDC disseminated it to statewide labs, then they had to recall those tests back again, right? And then they had to wait another 2 or 3 weeks to make a new test, scale it up, and then now we are without tests. Now, the WHO was offering us tests.
Free.
Now, at that time, what could we have done? Like, the idea of doing testing right now, I think it's a joke. I've long since stopped telling people to go get tested for C19. And in fact, we can talk about the clinical aspects of C19 if you want as well. Wait, because I've looked at
tests and
evaluated over 1,000 people. So I have a pretty good idea of how this virus and how the virus works in humans. But what happened was that they did not take the test at that time. Had they known it, that closed door presentation, I guarantee you, I can't guarantee, but I strongly suspect that they probably were also given what recommendations are to do next. And I would imagine, again, I told you public health is not complicated. It's pretty obvious how to do things, right? They probably then said, well, we should start testing people aggressively, right? Because at the point that we could do those testing, you would be able to start doing contact tracing. And it's contact tracing that's really, really, really important. That's that example. That I said, oh, hey, you turned positive. Where were you in the last 2 weeks? Oh, you went to a bachelor party in Las Vegas. Well, wow. Tell me who else was there. You know, this is what I did when I was, you know, doing the Ebola epidemic in Sierra Leone. I initially started off as an Ebola doctor, but got transferred over into the epidemiology section where I was doing surveillance, where I was tracking down active cases, pulling people out, putting them into the Ebola treatment centers, quarantining the families, and constantly looking at them with the eye of a ID doctor, of an infectious disease doctor, and then recognizing when they had Ebola, and then pulling them out and getting them into a treatment hospital. But that was the first point that they could have done something. The idea of like shutting down borders and all that stuff, that was ridiculous. There's no need for that. We have seen that's not necessary. That's the sort of thing that you do when you're behind the eight ball. But at that point, they were way ahead of the eight ball, and testing with good surveillance and contact tracing would have been the way to go.
You are listening to WHIV-LP New Orleans 102.3. This show is Good Morning Comrade. We have Scott and Jeff, and we also have a special guest, Mark Allendary. We're talking about the COVID-19 virus. And that was really interesting that so the first policy decision that we made, and I kind of like want to dilate on this a minute too. So the we did nothing on a policy level. And when we finally
did, they called it a hoax.
They called it a hoax. They called it
Fox News was calling it a hoax. People were saying that this was, you know, that this was the Democrats' way of getting back at the president. They couldn't impeach him. Bob Mueller's, couldn't do anything with him. Russiagate and all that stuff. They were calling this a hoax. They knew this was not a hoax.
And it's, and that is absolutely right. And it's important to recognize also what, because you also mentioned that closing and shutting down transportation and borders and all these other things was a, COVID-19 was used as a justification to do that. And so as people who are in the U.S. paying attention already know, that's been the objective of the Trump administration since 20 days in. Well, I was at JFK Airport when that big demonstration happened the first week of the Trump administration, and they already wanted to do that. So they were using this as an opportunity to shut down borders that they already wanted to shut down and do nothing else as a policy response. So it's one of it's one of these sort of like convenient applications of a crisis. And that's something that I think is always worth acknowledging and paying attention to.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% agree with you. I mean, this is not unlike something that, you know, like you said, this was, you know, this has been the policy, I think, for evangelical, people
nationalists.
Who are, what's that?
Straight up nationalists. I mean, whether or not it's based on a religion, it doesn't particularly matter. I mean, but the issue for me becomes when you start restricting the movement of people, but you don't restrict the flow of capital over borders.
let's be very clear here. We are moving closer and closer into an authoritarian government. I know that I'm speaking. I'm sorry that my computer.
It's fine. Like,
Do you hear that? I'm sorry that's
cool. It's cool.
I'm sorry. I don't know how to turn off the text. I've turned off my text message, but they're still coming through. I'm sorry.
I've been mad at you.
What is, you know, we are, and if we, you know, so here's something. He never was able to get up beyond 40% approval ratings, right, president.
Yeah.
And now with these daily meetings where he's projecting confidence and he's projecting, and it's just sheer lies. It's just, these are vehicles for him to be able to lie.
Mm-hmm.
His approval rating right now is north of 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I see a path to victory, you know, and another 4 years, like this is, I mean, we are sliding very, very quickly into an authoritarian government.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, where is the Democratic Party?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Where's Nancy Pelosi? Where is Chuck Schumer, right? Where is the doddering, you know, Joe Biden, you know, who just basically came out and said, well, I'm not going to criticize the president at this time of national crisis.
Doesn't he know, like, he has to beat that guy?
Yeah, what a dummy.
Like, that's it. Like I've been saying this for the longest time. There needs to be a third party. Like, there needs to be a third party. I don't understand. I don't understand. Like, Bernie was right there, and then they just snatch it away again, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, like he didn't, like, you. Biden couldn't get 10 people to show up at a rally, uh-huh, right? And now all of a sudden he's the front runner?
Yeah.
Because who? Because Buttigieg gave him the thumbs up, because Senator Kamala Harris said, oh, that's who I'm going to go behind. Cory Booker was like, that's my boy. You know, like, come on. You know, like,
It's a long running.
We need to rise up as a working class group of people. We need to rise up and we need to do something different, right? Because essentially, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Mm-hmm. The donors are the same on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Sure, and it's in a lot of senses, it's a good cop, bad cop sort of situation. There's a running sort of narrative that we talk about on this show a lot. Which is essentially that the Democratic Party is much, much, much more interested in mitigating and, like, holding the left flank of what is possible to basically eliminate any kind of chance of an actual left or any kind of an actual, like, working class representing party to step up and fill it in. So as a result of that, you see the way that, like, mainstream Democrats behave is that they'll attack the left far more viciously than they would ever do the right wing. They would absolutely destroy the left wing because they have much more. They hate the left.
Hate progressives. Mm-hmm. And you know why they hate progressives? Because they know that progressives have nowhere else to go.
Mm-hmm. Or they bank on it at least.
It's time to start a third party. When you start a third party, okay, when there is, then all of a sudden you're going to start watching the Democratic Party coming to, that's where the leverage is. But right now there is no leverage right now. And so, like, what opposition party, it was this great comment that said that the representative Ocasio-Cortez said a couple weeks ago when she said, in what country would I be, you know, in the same party as Joe Biden? It just doesn't exist. Right.
Right.
And she was right. You know, she was right. Like, They hate progressives and they kowtow to Republicans. And the more right wing and the more crazy that Republican is, and the more conservative and the more ideologues they are, the more they cower to them.
They get out of the way because that's a political.
It's unbelievable. Katie Hill had a consensual relationship with a staffer, and she got drummed out. Where you get these guys that otherwise would just
Joe Biden's running for president right now.
I mean, Dianne Feinstein's still in.
What's that?
Dianne Feinstein's doing all right. Nobody's talking about her.
Yeah.
Well, Joe Biden is literally, like, they had a case of Tara Reid, who just came out and said that she'd been sexually assaulted I don't want to get into details, but she was sexually assaulted by Joe Biden.
Brutal.
Media
to hear her talk about it is brutal.
Mm-hmm. It's very, very like hair raising, and you know, I don't want to get into it because this one's going out on the radio, but essentially like that is something that's not getting any kind of coverage, any kind of like push against. But that doesn't stop sort of like Democrats from talking about like Bernie being a sexist or whatever.
Right. No, but you know, but again, where is the opposition party having pressers after every single one of the president's press conference, mm-hmm. highlighting lie after lie after mm-hmm. lie? Like, it just, it's not there. They are completely ineffective. They're completely incompetent, mm-hmm. or they may be competent in the sense that they just
they're holding don't that left care. Flank. They're holding that left flank right. down.
Right.
I mean, I feel like it's just all these guys with the same lawyers, like on the left and the right. I mean, on like the Democrats and the Republicans.
Right.
These are all guys with like the same lawyers.
Right. Roger Daltrey said it great. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's true. The bottom line. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. That's what it is. And again. And I'm watching the president bumble and fumble his way through this. This is an unprecedented outbreak of that was completely preventable. Lives are going to be lost as a result of this. There is a clear prioritization of capital over people, mm-hmm. but the president is now up 10 points. There's nobody publicly talking against him. He's muted the CDC. Mm-hmm. He's almost practically muted Fauci. Mm-hmm. Like, that's it. Like, he's like, this is it. He's going to bumble and fumble his way into 2020, into another 4 years, into picking new Supreme Court justices, to picking more federal judges that have lifetime appointments. Mm-hmm. And this country will become an authoritarian haven where you will see an exploitation of the working classes.
More so than we already do.
Much more so, with incredible financial inequities, health inequities, social inequities, racial inequities, mm-hmm. You know, at the behest of the ruling class.
It's on steroids, basically just capitalism on steroids, racism, and all of the things that come along with capitalism on steroids. Yeah, that's sort of like where we're headed. Yikes. That's a big yikes right there. One of the things, hold on one second. So you were listening to WHIV LP New Orleans 102.3. This show is Good Morning Comrade. We have Mark Allendary, and we also have Scott and Jeff Barawa. One of the things that I sort of like, because you just sort of like dragged us in that direction, and I think it's really important to address. What is the world?
I didn't drag you into anything. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm following you in that direction because I choose to do so willingly. Sure. How about that? One of those. But I think about this now. So I'm a teacher, right? What we've sort of noticed and realized in this sort of situation is what is important and what isn't important, right? Right now, I'm a teacher. I'm in contact with my kids and things like that from home. But the custodians and the people who work, like do the quote unquote, you know, jobs that anybody can do, the low value jobs or whatever, they're the ones that are charged with cleaning up the school and all of this stuff. People, I mean, they make less than $15 an hour. People who are at work at grocery stores, you know, bagging groceries, ringing up groceries, stocking shelves, those people are working right now. So you can sort of see when they talk about who is and who, and obviously doctors and nurse practitioners. And actually, I have a pretty interesting story from a friend of mine in St. Paul who's talking about their hospitals are trying to get people to come in without PPE, personal equipment, masks, scrubs, and the stuff that you were talking about. Fascinating stuff. Like terrifying, fascinating. But anyway, it's being laid bare in our society right now. Who is actually important and who is actually essential and who is not? Because and I've mentioned this on the show in the past, if you don't have anybody stocking your shelves at your grocery store, people are going to starve. If a hedge fund manager or some, you know, mid-level whatever in the, you know, in a banking, you know, speculation side of banking organization misses their job, guess what? Nobody loses a thing. So looking at the other side of this, do you think that there is opportunities to sort of recognize these realities and these sort of the importance of these kinds of that kind of work over the other kinds of work?
I have stopped being and looking at these sorts of things with an optimistic perspective. I think that tribalism, read racism, and classism, and misogyny, are so deeply rooted in the American experience. Mm. This country was founded on the genocide of First Nation peoples, the stolen labor, the kidnapping, the brutal rape and exploitation and torture of people that were taken from Africa, the continued misogyny. We were just talking about Joe Biden a moment ago. And then what you have is the ruling classes that are constantly looking toward the lower classes, the working classes, and trying to separate people by race.
Yep, carving it up, chop it into a puzzle piece.
They're trying to separate people by religion. Mm-hmm. They're trying to separate people by race, religion, by belief in pro-life.
By which sports team they like.
Right. So, you know, if this country was so goddamn pro-life, like, does this coronavirus also, like, completely rip the Band-Aid off of the notion that we are so pro-life? If we were so pro-life, we should have been, you know, the whole idea of pro-life is really anti-women. It's to punish women for being sexually, for being sexual, right? It's the ultimate form of controlling women's bodies. You know, right. To not allow women to have their own autonomy over their bodies. When the upper classes are telling the lower classes that they should look down upon people that are even lower than them, That's when the lower classes should look up to the upper classes and give them a big middle finger.
Right.
You know, that's what they need to be doing, okay? Because that's what you do. You look down, you're able to tell white people, hey, look at the Latin people, Latinx people are stealing your jobs, and then you foster a significant amount of xenophobia. You know, look at the the ad that Bush Senior did, the Willie Horton, right? The classic Willie Horton ad, right? Mm-hmm. You know, again, it was this idea of fomenting hatred amongst people of different ethnicities, black and white separation. That's how the ruling classes are able to maintain their ruling class. So people in America, here's something that's unique about Americans amongst the things that we are the number one country that believe in angels more than anybody else. And we have some of the worst healthcare, if not the worst healthcare of all the industrialized countries. Here's something unique about Americans is that we consistently vote against our own best interests. Mm-hmm. Our quote unquote founding fathers, as difficult and as complicated people as they were, they did give us the opportunity to have one person, one vote. Of course, it was flawed, mm-hmm. and of course, it took several decades, if not centuries, to fix some of that stuff. But for the most part, we were given the ability to engage in voting. But
it's a constantly
population just votes. They just vote against their own interests. Mm-hmm. They don't care. Like, they continue to vote for entities, for politicians that just don't care about them, that just will, you know, that care more for their donors, campaign donors, than they do for their own people. And it's just out in the open. People see it. They know it. But as long as they're able to foment that level of racism, and that's what mm-hmm. this president is doing brilliantly.
So that's
we think the president is an idiot. Mm-hmm. President is a brilliant marketer, mm-hmm. and he is brilliant. He has an amazing way of getting people to really, he taps into that level of anger and frustration that people feel.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think about too, in terms of a looking forward kind of in response to that, is how do you address that in a way that is going to, you know, how do you essentially organize, you know, working class people of all races, all you know, identities and genders and all that other stuff? How do you assemble that Voltron? You know what I mean? And that's the interesting question. And I'm not asking for an answer necessarily, but that's sort of like one of the,
you know, I look to my organizing friends, you mm-hmm. know, to do stuff like that. You know, for me, the thing that I could do was I started WHIV where mm-hmm. we could have conversations like this, mm-hmm. you know, but like, you know, I'm full-time, you know, infectious disease doctor right now, busier than I've ever been in my life right. in the United States. I've been busy like this in responding to outbreaks around the world, but like we said at the top of the show, never in the US. Mm-hmm. But I look to you, mm-hmm. Jeff. I look to you, Scott. I look to Jenny Yanez. I look to Martha. I look to the Coalition of Day Laborers, mm-hmm. right? I look to DSA. I look to you know, the people in this city that do an amazing job of advocacy. Right, mm-hmm. I've opened up the airwaves for WHIV to make that available so that these conversations can be had from start to finish, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WHIV. But how to do more, I don't know. I think the only answer is a third party, right? Mm-hmm. I think that for people who, you know, and I talk to my friends in DC, because I have friends that run radio stations in DC that are progressive, people who are very politically connected, mm-hmm. You know, people who, you know, the person who wrote the Bernie's Medicare for All, it was actually Pramila
Jayapal,
representative of Pramila Jayapal. It was her proposal. Mm-hmm. Sorry, guys. Hang on 1 second. Text messages and FaceTimes all at the same time.
You're good.
Sorry. Is a good friend of mine. He wrote the Medicare for All proposal for Representative Jayapal. And when I talked to him about third party, it just like, he's like, no third party, right? Mm-hmm. I talked to a good friend who has a radio program on WHIV. It's a national radio show on WHIV. And when I asked him about third party, he's like, no, we're not interested in a third party. We really need to be focusing on regaining the Democratic Party. That's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's never going to happen.
So
right now, it's a humdinger. You stand up every single day that the president does his pressers. You stand up mm-hmm. a half hour later, highlighting all the lies, and then doing something like, where are the tests, Mr. President? Where are the tests? And there's nothing. There is nothing. This is a... like it is political malpractice. Mm-hmm. And then what we're seeing as a result of that is the fact that we're seeing people who are going to be dying mm-hmm. and there's going to be a lot of pain coming forward as a result of C-19.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, as sort of like a last point, because you brought up the radio station WHIV. This program airs primarily on WHIV. Can you just give a bit of information about that, and how can you support the station?
I mean, right now we recognize that that times are very, very tough for a lot of people. We have always we've been 100% volunteer run, and we've been 100% we run on donations and monthly memberships. I haven't talked to our treasurer recently, but I anticipate that things are tough. Mm-hmm. And WHIV as a small business is going to be hurt. We are committed to staying on air. If anybody here does believe in our mission, please, we ask that you donate to WHIVFM.org/support. That's WHIVFM.org/support. It is important that community radio like this, independent voices, dissenting voices like ours are heard. Because when I do media all day long, right? that's what I've been doing is media. Mm-hmm. But I can't have these conversations on WWL. I can't have these conversations on the various Q91, all the various, I can't even,
I've radio talked stations
now than ever before. Mm-hmm. But we can have these conversations here. The people who are listening to your show, the people mm-hmm. who listen to WHIV, care about this sort of stuff. And while I have your ear, if I could just say a couple more things. I know that everybody recognizes the importance of hand washing. I cannot underestimate or stress enough, rather, the importance of hand washing, soap and water, hand sanitizers, 60 to 90% with alcohol in it. Please stop shaking hands. Don't give hugs mm-hmm. Unless these are people that you're living with. Stay the F indoors. Please, unless you have an essential job. Jeff, you talked about some of the heroes. Let me pay deep, deep respect and love to the clerks that are at grocery stores, mm-hmm. to the clerks that are at pharmacies, to the bank tellers that are right there in front of people handling money. Now, this virus is not transmitted on money. There's a lot of other stuff that's transmitted on money. This one isn't. So you're okay using money at a grocery store, but if you are a clerk at a grocery store or at a pharmacy, please wash your hands with hand sanitizer after every encounter with a client. But those are people that I respect deeply and are heroes. Please be sure if you have a cough, you have to treat a cough. Do not assume a cough is going to go away by itself. Go to the pharmacy and get some cough suppressants and take it around the clock. That's how you treat a cough. Otherwise, you will continue to cough indefinitely. I promise you that. And lastly, we need to really be focusing on four populations that I think are going to be incredibly hurt as a result of this. And those four populations are those individuals in nursing homes. Mm-hmm. We saw, I think, something like a half a dozen plus new clusters of nursing homes, of cases in nursing homes around the New Orleans metro area today. It's going to be those people who are in ICE detention centers, mm-hmm. immigration centers, those individuals, those people who are in the carceral system,
yeah, prisons, yeah.
are very much at risk. And then lastly, those people that are in homeless shelters or in areas where people have experienced housing instability. These are areas and places where people are incredibly vulnerable. So please do what you can to send good vibes, energies, love, whatever it is that you do. Mm-hmm. And lastly, please check up on the people who are older in your community or in your families, your loved ones, because they are most vulnerable, not only to this disease process, but also for dying as a result mm-hmm. Of acquiring this virus.
So Mark, you said something interesting. If you kind of treat this like a cough, like, and just don't assume that your fever will break, is that like pretty key?
Yeah, you want to treat your fever, so ibuprofen, naproxen, or Tylenol to treat your fever, discomfort, sore throat, body aches, what have you. But Tessalon Perls, which is something that you would have to go to a doctor for. A lot of the clinics here, you know, I do 100% Medicaid. I work for the largest Medicaid providing clinic system in the state of Louisiana, at Access Health Louisiana. And so we're doing all telemedicine. So if you're on Medicaid, please contact us. We'd be happy to see you and do a telehealth visit with you. But Tessalon Perls, and if you can't do Tessalon Perls, Mucinex is perfectly fine. Any of the other over-the-counter cough suppressants, not expectorants. Mm-hmm. Don't cough to think that you've got to cough something out. This idea of coughing something out, that's not really a thing, right? Stuff is so deep inside your lungs. You know what it is that's inside your lungs? It's inflammatory fluid. Mm-hmm. You know what happens to inflammatory fluid? It just goes away by itself. Mm-hmm. Don't think that you have to cough it up, because if you're trying to cough up something, people are like, oh, I've got green sputum. I'm like, all right, I didn't even ask you what color your sputum was, because I don't care. Like, not mean that you have an infection, right? It just means that your sputum is green. I don't even know. Maybe you had a green now later, 30 minutes ago. I don't know, right? It doesn't matter. Like, don't try to cough anything up.
Yeah.
Suppress the cough, right? Because when you irritate your lung, because when you cough, you irritate a part of your lung. And then a signal goes to your brain saying, hey, I'm irritated. And then the brain responds with, oh, well, the only thing I know how to do when the lung is irritated is cough.
It's a reflex, right?
And, right. And then that irritates more of the lungs, right? Mm-hmm. And then a signal goes back up to the brain saying, I'm irritated. And then the brain says, well, okay, I'm going to respond with a cough. And then it irritates more. And then it sets up a feed-forward mechanism.
Scumbag like brain.
Cough begets cough. The more you cough, the more you cough. So you have to stop the cough with a cough suppressant.
Okay.
Cough suppressant. And take it around the clock. It only works if you take it around the clock. The more you cough, the harder it is to take it under, keep it under control. And if you're a smoker, it's also hard. It's going to take a couple more days for you to keep your cough under control.
Mm-hmm. Once I heard about this, I stopped smoking. Like, I quit cold. I was like, I don't even need false coughing around here. Like, I didn't know what this business.
All right. Well, you can listen to Good Morning Comrade. Thank you again, Mark Allen. You can listen to Good Morning Comrade every Tuesday on WHIV-FM. You can get more information, whivfm.org/good-morning-comrade. You can listen online anywhere in the world, whivfm.org/listen. And get more information about Good Morning Comrade and our next shows on goodmorningcomrade.com. Thanks.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
All right. Yeah. Bye.